Thank you so much, JE5, for having us. For our first song, we will be singing a very angry breakup song called Ahava Katana, meaning a little love, as in I don't even have a little love for you, which is the way Rhythm and Jews feels about the Hamantash. So,
yep.
In the song, the part of the Hamantash will be played by David Mao.
Din 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 oh din 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 oh na 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 na
Hayu meleotava
הייתה איתי והייתי איתה ברחוב השירים שעפו את החדר הייתי כולי שערה ומה שנות הלב הסוף מהשבר ברחוב הנקלים נותרה שתיקה ברחוב הבריחות עוברית זה הזם אני זוכר מה שרוע קרה ברוב הרוחות וסופות הגשם בסוף היום חזרה חזרה בסוף היום חזרה חזרה Let us go
This is the end. Hold your breath and count to ten. Feel the earth move and then hear my heart burst again. Father God,
Rhythm and Jews.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, yentas and mishiganas, welcome to the 67th annual Laka Hamantash debate. Thank you all for coming. My name is Adam Getzler, and I'm here with my colleague Phil Carlitz, and will soon be joined by my colleagues Naren Hazaran Singh and Ross Parquet. This year, as we do every year, we will try to answer the question of which food reigns supreme. The battle of savory versus sweet, potato versus dough, Hanukkah versus Purim may never be won. But this year, we will hopefully come closer to the answer. Led by our fearless moderator and our keen debaters, we attempt to answer this question while also making the audience excruciatingly hungry.
The Laka Hamantash debate is a crucially important event for global Jewry. After all, only a few days ago, the P5+1 nations came to an agreement with Iran, which could impact Israel's national security for decades. And yet, I will soon be joined by four doctoral scholars to debate whether a shallow fried potato is better than a filled pocket cookie. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the University of Chicago. Joining us today are elected officials, foreign diplomats, members of university administration, and Toronto Mayor Rob Ford.
He's not here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just told that Mayor Ford could not make it. I have no idea why. But before we continue, I'd like to thank our student leaders and volunteers, Jess Green and Jusa, UChicago Dining, Jen Kennedy, and the Student Government Finance Committee for all your hard work in making this event possible. In addition, thank you. In addition, this event would not be possible without the help of the Brothers of AEPI, so thank you guys for that.
One of the key values of the Alpha Epsilon Pi fraternity is our commitment to philanthropy. According to Maimonides, the highest level of charity is to give so that one becomes self-sufficient. The Save a Child's Heart Foundation enables children to become just that. Its goal is to help children, regardless of race, color, creed, or financial consideration, to be treated with the finest medical care for life-threatening cardiac disease. Truly a righteous cause. All proceeds from tonight's debate will be going to this cause, including t-shirt sales and tasting sales afterwards, so please donate what you can at the table outside after the debate. And, well, actually, without further ado, we would like to welcome our debaters.
For the past 67 years, the Lacka-Hamantash debate has followed a set of general guidelines. The participants in the debate must be the recipients of doctoral degrees and be faculty members at the University of Chicago. I am pleased to note that tonight is significant because for the first time in debate history, two of our professors are female. I'd like to remind everyone to fill out the ballots inside your program and hand them to an usher as you leave the auditorium. After the debate, there will be a reception in Hutch Commons where you can enjoy refreshments and a sampling of vodkas and Hamantaschen.
Professor Cohen, Professor Ted Cohen, is a man who needs no introduction, and yet I'm here to give him one anyway. Dr. Cohen has moderated this debate ever since God invented the Lacka and the Hamantash. Professor Cohen has now taught in the philosophy department for 44 years, receiving his bachelor's degree from the University of Chicago in 1962, and then his PhD from the University of Chicago of the East Coast in 1972. Along the way, he has written many books and essays relating to subjects which he agrees are far less important than the topic we will be debating today. It is now with great pleasure that I introduce Professor Ted Cohen.
I'm sorry for the miserable condition of my voice. My doctor says it's not serious. My voice will recover, but for now, I just have to inflict it on you. If it becomes so low that you can't hear it, maybe you should be grateful for that. If you can hear me and find it painful to listen, it may console you to know that I am in no pain whatever. You know, I'm accustomed to begin with a calendar calculation meant to determine just what number this will be in the very long history of the debate. But I will not do that tonight. Why not? Well, as you no doubt noticed last year, the debate is no longer under the aegis of Hillel. And this is the second year without Hillel's sole sponsorship. The reason for this, as you no doubt know, is one of those internecine affairs Jews specialize in. And I will not go into that. Instead, let us embrace a new calendar. You also know that much of the world denominates years as either AD or BC. Jews are unhappy with these dates because they refer to a savior in whom Jews tend not to believe. So instead of AD, in the year of the Lord, BC, before Christ, Jews say BCE, before the Christian era, and CE, the Christian era. So I propose that the first several of these debates, numbering, despite what you just heard, well past 60, carry the designation H. Thus, the first debate was in 1H, the first year Hillel sponsored it. And last year was 1AH, the first year after Hillel. So welcome to the 2H debate. Some of you have mentioned, not always kindly, that some of my material circulates from earlier years. Well, now that we're in the year's H, everything counts as new. This year we have 3 participating debaters. I'm sorry to tell you that until now, I was unfamiliar with the truly impressive work they've done. Perhaps you will be acquainting yourself with these mavens for the first time, and so you may hear some exceedingly arcane material you are not sure how to regard. A piece of my own autobiography may be of help. A few years ago, my wife and I were in a nightclub in Tel Aviv. We were listening to a stand-up comic perform. During the performance, a New York Jew at a neighboring table laughed often and loudly. When the performance was finished, I couldn't help asking the New York Jew how he had managed such an appreciation, given that the comic had performed entirely in Hebrew, while the New York Jew knew no Hebrew at all. "It's okay," he said to me. "I trust these people." I assure you that you can trust tonight's people, and I now turn to introduce them. Kerry Rinker-Schaefer is professor in the Department of Surgery, the Department of Medicine, the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the Cancer Research Center, the Committee on Cancer Biology, Committee on Genetics, and she is the director of urology research. She pursued her doctoral research on the identification of metastasis suppressor genes for prostate cancer at Johns Hopkins. Her major interest is in identifying genes which regulate prostate cancer metastasis. She and her co-workers have transferred human chromosomes 17, 12, and 13 into highly metastatic prostate and breast cancer cells to test the ability of these microcell hybrids to suppress metastasis in SCID mice. They help with these introductions. I neither know nor care whether you understand. Because, as a matter of fact, Professor Rinker Schaefer is best known for her work in oncology, despite which her work there has led her to groundbreaking work in another lab, one dealing with human sexuality. And that's what I'm privileged to tell you about. As science has come to understand, the transgender is a matter of human biology and sex determination. Professor Rinker Schaefer has undertaken a deep understanding of just how it is that X and Y chromosomes are activated and deactivated in embryonic humans. And as of next week, first week of December, she will publish a truly revolutionary result in which she announces that her lab has now succeeded in breeding a human being with the major sex characteristics of both male and female humans. This laboratory creation, miraculously so it would seem, has both a penis and a brain. Amazing. I expect her performance tonight to be no less. Professor Carrie Rinker Schaefer.
Oh, geez. That was great, actually. I don't know if I want to do that stuff anymore. It seems so boring now. Oh, I haven't heard about it. So it is an incredible honor and privilege to be here tonight with you. I want to thank Adam for inviting me. And I'm going to talk to you tonight about the Hamantash. I'm actually going to tell a story about how I came to the conclusion that it was imperative for me to support the Hamantash, because that's not what I thought initially when Adam asked me to do this talk, because like many people who are, less than Hebrew, I was introduced to the latke early on by friends and family members, and so, not direct family members, but people that kind of came into our family. And so I went home, and I was very excited about this, and I was, got to my family, who cannot be here tonight because they're both really sick with the flu, and I'm sorry that they can't be here because they inspire everything that I do. As a matter of fact, I thought you were going to make a joke about my family when you made the comment about the transgender. There's a lot of good jokes in the urology department about those two items you talked about. I'll tell you about later. But anyway, I went home, and I was very excited to share my news with my family, and my husband's like, what debate is that? What is it? And I told him, it's the history of this. And that they've been having these and how it got started and all that. And my son's, that's very interesting. And my husband's just sitting there looking at me and kind of laughing. And I said, what's wrong? He goes, you are the whitest woman in America. I cannot believe you're going to be talking in this thing. And my son, this is my son, Carl, who is very high-functioning, has autism. He's on the autism spectrum, and he's very high-functioning. And he gives fantastic talks about being on the autism spectrum, and he advocates for students on the spectrum and in a society that Foundation, Golden Hat Foundation, put a plug for them that he works with. But he says, oh, wait, what? And my husband said, well, she's the whitest woman ever. And he looked at me and says, I'm sure this is not some kind of a literal thing, but I'm not familiar with it, so please tell me you were never involved in a white supremacist group. And I said, no. And so what does that mean exactly? And I said, well, I'm not really, because we go places, I say, yeah, it's not what it means. And I said, well, what I think your dad's getting at is that I grew up in a really small town, and it was kind of culturally bereft. As a matter of fact, I pulled this up because this is really true. Much of what I will tell you tonight is true. You have to figure out which parts I made up. But I grew up in the northeastern corner of Ohio, where it happens to be that Night of the Living Dead was filmed. So it was actually really, I never wanted to be out at night by myself where I grew up. And so I explained to Carl that, my son's name is Carl, that, you know, it was kind of bereft of culture and that, you know, through these different things. I said, but, you know, I'm Supiani. He goes, well, wait a minute. I said, yeah. And he goes, well, do you know anything about the Hamantash? And I said, no. He says, well, aren't you going to do some research? I said, well, I know about the law. Mother, do I need to talk to you again about this topic? And you remember what you told me about how never to jump to conclusions about cultural issues after the great disaster of 2003? Do you remember the Martin Luther King disaster? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, you remember? I said, oh. And he was referring to a time when he was in primary school, and I met him on the train coming back from the Field Museum where he'd been with my husband, and he, a small little boy, you know, you saw what he looked like, was proud to announce to me that he said, I'm so proud to be an African-American mom. I was like, what? And, he, you know, I was like, sit down. You know? And he said that he'd been to the Field Museum and that he had learned that everyone came from a mitochondrial Eve. And so he was proud of his African heritage. So as a parent, I can tell you there's a mixing, like, oh, I'm so happy he doesn't notice that we have no color. But and also, you know, you can't say that. So, you know, later we talked about it, and he felt, so I said, no, I think that was really admirable. But he brought it up, we chatted about it, and he says, you really need to do a little digging. And he says, let me know what you find out. So I went, I did a little cursory thing on the web, and I came back, and I said, okay, so here's the deal. There's this guy, Haman. And he was kind of, he's sort of advised the king in Persia. You know, I think he was kind of like Zazu in The Lion King, because I'm white, right? You know, so, and my son, I describe a little more, and he goes, no, he sounds more like a vizier. I said, what? And he said, you know, like in Aladdin, Mom, you know, and I said, oh. So then I looked a little more, and it turns out it's really amazing that if you look online, the picture that you find, of course, no one knows exactly what he looked like, but the picture on the left is supposed to be Haman. Picture on the right, of course, is of a person that never really lived. But anyway, that's Jafar from Aladdin. So, you know, I said, oh, you know, yeah, I get it. I can totally get the story because Disney, white girl, princesses. You know, you got Esther, she becomes a princess, and you know, stuff, you know, he's explaining it. And I said, you know, she had to be really brave, but, you know. And my son goes, oh, who's the king? I said, I'll show you the name is. So you think this was like a Disney film? I said, no, it was worse than a Disney film. There was going to be, you know, persecution and extermination. Yeah. So he goes, no, do you think it was like being married to a prince in a Disney film? I said, I don't know. And he goes, Mom, do you know who Xerxes was? Did you watch 300 with me? So he says, I mean, that would be like a Disney movie from hell, Mom. Okay, it's not what that was about. You need to do some more digging. And so we chatted a bit more about it. And I said, well, you know, I do know somebody who could probably help me out with this. So I went ahead and I got ready to take a trip. Person who's the great-grandson of Professor Ravenwood, who used to be at the University of Chicago. That's pretty good, huh? I did that right. And they're actually in a northern Colorado university. I said, look, you know, I have this problem. I really want to track this down. My son has pointed out to me that because I grew up in a culturally bereft area, I'm basically just a clean, empty slate, and yet I have this real bias toward Latkes. And I don't understand where that could possibly have come from. And I forgot to mention that my son had actually been nice enough to sit me down and tell me about how the media influences teenage girls, and that probably happened when I was young, too, and I might not even have known what was going on. I swear to God, that is true. My son will be the only guy in the women's studies classes this summer that he's going to take, which I think is fantastic. I'm so proud of him. But anyway, this friend of mine said, well, you know, I do have something that was passed down to my family that you might want to look at. We're going to figure this out. And he handed me this book. It's very old. It's very ancient. And it's actually quite good because it's a lot like, you know, the diary. It's also a little dusty. But anyway, it turned out, oh, geez. Hey, you got to go for the laughs. So we pulled out a map of ancient Persia, and we started discussing that thing. He says, you know, my great-grandfather did have some very interesting notes in here. And it seems that actually he was interested in the tribe that Haman was from. They caused a lot of trouble over the years. It seemed like over and over and over again. And so what we found as we dug through the artifacts in his great-grandfather's collection is that it turns out that the descendants of Haman wound up being potato farmers. Yeah, potato farmers. And so this is actually some pictures and then one of the passports for when they came to the United States and left. And apparently, they really, really had a problem. I mean, they were kind of irritated with what happened to Haman. And it turns out that the descendants went in two directions. When they got to the United States, surprisingly enough, some of them, because they were potato farmers, relocated to one of the whiter states in the Union, Idaho, where they could continue their farming specialty. I knew some things about Idaho, but I didn't know that they goosed dogs in Idaho until I pulled this picture off the web. You might notice a man holding a little dog by that sign. And so that answered a little bit about their love for potatoes and the kind of strategy to get people to like potatoes and ignore the Hamantash. The other line, the family actually located in California, and some of the family members, the descendants, actually worked on the first Star Wars movie. And what you might notice, if you look very carefully at many movies, is that a lot of them have this triangular shape associated with bad guys, okay? And it turns out that I, like my son after me, huge Star Wars fan. And so those 400 or 500 times I saw the movie when I was growing up, and then again with my son, it's clear.
I know. What happened?
Do you see a similarity? You're probably wondering whether to be impressed that I own this or disturbed by the fact that I would bring it with me. But in conclusion, I think that not only are the Hamantaschen incredibly tasty and delicious, but also because of a vast potato-based conspiracy, a person who is bereft of any kind of long cultural lineage could be influenced, taken under their spell, so to speak, to ignore the delightful and amazing Hamantash. So I conclude my argument for them about how this all came about, and I want to again thank folks for being kind enough to invite me, and I do want to close with a serious note. This has been a great experience to discuss with my son and to learn more about. And in those discussions, I was able to mention to him the fact that I seriously did grow up in that town, by the way. And I'm quite certain I would not have gotten out of that town, done the things that I've done, and enjoyed myself without the help of so many people from the Jewish community as I grew up. Thank you.
Harold Pollack is, what have you left here? Huh. is Helen Ross Professor at the School of Social Service Administration. He's also co-director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. Didn't know we had one, did you? His research appears in such journals as Addiction, Journal of the American Medical Association, and American Journal of Public Health. He received his undergraduate degree in electrical engineering and computer science from Princeton. He holds a doctorate in public policy from Harvard. His writings appear in the Washington Post, The Nation, The New York Times, The New Republic, and elsewhere. He is perhaps best known for his 2008 investigative piece titled, Barack Obama as the First Jewish President. He says his greatest lifetime achievement remains having won an intramural wrestling tournament. Some confusion has surrounded Professor Pollack's work at the University of Chicago Crime Lab. And I'm glad for this opportunity to set things straight. The Crime Lab's goal is to deal with crime and maybe reduce it. But it has come to be commonly believed that the lab is an institute for those wishing to study to be criminals. According to this belief, which I believe is now confirmed, the lab offers courses in elementary extortion, beginning burglary, and advanced criminal assault. Now, while this is almost certainly true, these courses are not free, and students must pay the full tuition fees, which income helps support the lab. This is the kind of enterprise Professor Pollack is known for, and I'm very proud to introduce him, Professor Harold Pollack.
Thank you, Professor Cohen. I should say all of those titles were current as of yesterday. This whole thing has been a nightmare, frankly. I'm just grateful that you've allowed me to come here today. I wore a disguise, actually. I found the hat. I blended right in with several of the departments on campus. I just kind of walked right through. But first of all, I was kind of surprised that they invited me, because although I'm Jewish, by the way, you're welcome for your life's achievements. I didn't know I was Jewish until I found my name in a newsletter that Ron Paul didn't write. They checked the list in Mel Gibson's pocket, and it was right there. So I knew I was good. But our family, we're ethical culture Jews. So, you know, for us, atheism is the central expression of Jewish identity. And in fact, behaviors like bar mitzvahs and synagogues are really quite goyish. So we recently sat shiva when my cousin Marty became observant there. As you can imagine, my dad is actually pretty devastated that I'm here today. He told me all the sacrifices I've made to send you to these fancy schmancy schools, and you repay me by doing the Latke Hamantaschen debate. I mean, at least it's not Hillel. That's a plus. But if I understand you're having a midlife crisis, but couldn't you, you know, become a Buddhist like that nice Cohen boy down the street? I mean, you know, they're kind of atheists, aren't they? Now, of course, given that background, I knew nothing about Latke or Hamantaschen. How am I supposed to choose a side in the debate? My knowledge of Judaism pretty much rests on some popular bestsellers. Shonda, My Career in Broadcasting by Geraldo Rivera, with Wolf Blitzer, Tie a Yellow Wristband Around the Old Oak Tree, Kabbalah Tales by Madonna, Old Guys Shooting Hoops with Irv at the Y by Barack Obama, and Frontiers of Yiddish Vocabulary by Rahm Emanuel. So, the thing is, if Adam Sandler had only written that Purim song like he promised to, I would have actually known what I was talking about, but he never got to it. So Anna Larkin actually said I would speak for the Humantashen team. I later regretted that because I did some research. Mainly, I actually tried to eat one, and notice how it bounces. So I couldn't let this stand. Of course, I didn't say anything to anybody because I was already committed. And now, one thing that Professor Cohen said was, Humantashen has a bit of an image problem, particularly in that critical 18 to 65 demographic. And I'm like, no kidding, when prune is your major flavor, why don't you just offer a free shuffleboard and a bocce ball with a Humantashen, So he went on to say, I hear the young people use websites. Why don't you make one? I'm going to put you in charge of one. I said, sure. I mean, how hard can that be? So you may have seen some of the ads, actually, that we've been running on TV for this debate. You won't, because that's a blank slide. I haven't gotten to the jokes yet. So we run these, and of course, since I'm such a celebrity, as you heard, the White House gets involved, and you'd be amazed how quickly $500 million can be spent. We basically blanketed the airwaves with these ads. Now, by August, I started getting some reports that things weren't going well with the website, But with John Boehner and Mitch McConnell doing their own Heyman impersonation, we set out to work. So finally, last week we tried to test the thing, and of course it crashed. A Seattle woman logged on. She tried to get a poppy seed recipe, and what she got instead was a soggy pastry potato kugel thing. I don't even know. And worse, we had security errors that allowed Vice President Biden to check 500 times into Natalie Portman's J-date profile. And so the rest. The website went live last week, and basically my life has been a wreck ever since. This was actually the first time I've been allowed on campus. And when I leave, I'm just going to pull this down so that people can see. What has it been like for me? What's it like to be me, I'll just show you some clips of what's been doing in the news media, and we'll see. I'll try not to get emotional, but we'll see if I can give you just a taste of it. This is the stuff that's. I see there's some kids here, so this is just what's appropriate for kids. Let's see if I can get this guy to work here.
Gosh, did you hear about Harold Pollack?
I know.
I can't believe it. Yeah. He like.
Is the debacle of Humantashen.gov a mere technical glitch? Professor Harold Pollack.
I should say that conspiracy theories have abounded, and this what you're about to hear is one of them.
Gosh, did you hear about Harold Pollack?
I know.
I can't believe it. Yeah. He like a TV show scandal.
Yeah.
Kind of like Jake. He's part of B613, but not as hot as Jake, though.
Is the debacle of Humantashen.gov a mere technical glitch? Professor Harold Pollack is surely right to say no. There are deeper, darker forces at work here. But at the same time, his analysis is so relentlessly partial as to be misleading, meaningless, fundamentally dishonest. The collapse of Hamantashka.gov has to be traced to a decision of the Jewish faction of American Jewry to attack the American faction of American Jewry. Now, this would matter only parochially were it not for the fact that America now has its first Jewish president, Baruch Obama. And therefore, the decision of the Obama administration to deliberately sabotage Hamantashka.gov represents a triumph of the Jewish over the Goyish faction of the American Jewish community.
This is the kind of crazy
and
stuff.
And it's to be expected that the Hamantash Jews and the Republican National Committee will strike back hard.
It gets worse, though.
But how could you have done so poorly? Don't you even know how to program in HTML? Didn't you have a punch list? I am so embarrassed, I'm afraid to go to the JCC. Shame on you, my son. Your loving mother.
Mom, I did.
This is the biggest scandal on campus since Leopold and Loeb, especially now with the university's big capital campaign. It may be never before Pollock ever is allowed on this campus again or to teach on this campus again.
It's not funny.
Dr. Pollock, Dr. Pollock, why did the website fail? Is your job in jeopardy?
Get off my lawn.
Hello, Mrs. Pollock. We have a few questions for you.
I told you before, no interviews. I don't know anything
just,
about
just a few questions. Just a moment.
No,
just a moment of your time.
Bye-bye.
Mrs. Pollock, we just have a few questions.
Oh, Harold doesn't talk about his work at home. I really don't know anything about it. Please,
just a few questions.
Just go away.
You're listening to WBEZ. I'm Nava Lara. Lockheed and Hamantash tasters are in the sixth hour of a lockdown in Hutchinson Hall as hundreds of protesters have surrounded the fast food dining room, making it impossible for anyone to leave. WBEZ's Robert Wildebor has more. Protesters say they want answers from university administrators as to why Professor Harold Pollack is still on staff. Pollack has been the center of controversy since WikiLeaks published documents showing that the diminutive professor may be responsible for one of the biggest gaffes of the Obama administration, the failed rollout of Hamantash.gov. It's just the latest in a series of recent political setbacks for President Barack Obama. According to a White House spokesman, by the end of the week, the president is expected to lay out a plan and timeline for fixing the website. Pollock has refused to return repeated calls from WBEZ, but we caught up with him briefly outside the School of Social Service Administration. But Pollock just muttered something about being, quote, just as successful as that Cohen boy from down the street, Dad, end quote. From the University of Chicago campus, I'm Robert Wildebor, WBEZ.
Hello.
Hi, is this Harold Pollack?
Who is this?
This is Jeffrey Toobin calling. Is this the Harold Pollack?
How did you get this number?
Did you crash the website?
No, of course not.
This is bigger than OJ. This is like Lewinsky level.
Why would you think that I crashed the website?
It's got your name all over it.
If you want to be the National Enquirer, what can I tell you?
That's my goal.
It's only November 27th, but Christmas has come early again for Republicans, or shall I say Hanukkah and Purim came early. Of course, I'm referring to the epic fail of Hamantash.gov at the University of Chicago. White House officials aren't talking, but the administration is reeling tonight as the latest revelations regarding the failed website are made public. But it's more than a website. This thing is bigger than any one president or administration. The entire future of liberal America is on the line. And if this thing fails, which it very well might, Democrats might be out of power for the next quarter century. Ironically enough, this entire fiasco may be traced back to Professor Harold Pollack. Personally disgraced, mocked by everyone from Rachel Maddow to Bill O'Reilly, he's now in seclusion somewhere in Chicago's south suburbs. Just a sad, sad day in the Windy City. We'll be back in a moment.
That's just a small, I assure you, that's just a small sample of what's been out there. And here's the thing, you know, what could have happened? Maybe it was an accident, but you know what? I took a taste of that Humantaschen, and you know, you have this gooey pastry thing. How can you make a successful website around a gooey pastry? And what if you did? That would just make things worse. So, I sabotaged the website. And I should tell you that my U of C career is over. All the titles have been stripped from me that Professor Cohen read. I brought down a president and created a national crisis. One person came close to guessing what happened. And I'll just say here, there's one person, the internet, every now and then you find these crazy people who are right and no one believes them.
What allowed the Latke faction in the Obama administration to pull off this dark coup? The potato is part of the traditional Kenyan diet. The prune is not. And that, my friends, is the rest of the story, the part Professor Harold Pollack would prefer you not to know.
But I will just tell you, it's all been worth it. When you have a taste of that slightly crunchy, slightly greasy latke with a little bit of sour cream on it, it's awesome, and it's all been worth it. So thank you very much.
Rachel Fulton Brown is Associate Professor of Medieval History. She is the author of From Judgment to Passion, Devotion to Christ and the Virgin Mary, and of numerous articles, including My Psalter, Myself, or How to Get a Grip on the Office, according to Jan Mombayer. She was the recipient of the Quantrell Award for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching. Her courses for the college have included War in the Middle Ages, Knights and Samurai, and Tolkien, Medieval and Modern. She's particularly concerned that you know of her researches on Tolkien because of her talk tonight. While she has never battled a dragon herself, she keeps a baby dragon on guard in her office, whom you can meet if you come to see her during office hours. During her studies of Jesus' mother, Mary, Professor Brown realized something that has revolutionized Mariology. You are no doubt familiar with arguments long thought to prove that Jesus must have been Jewish. Namely, he lived at home until he was pretty old. Then he went into what he thought was his father's business, and his mother thought he was a god. Certainly sounds Jewish. But Professor Brown has pointed out that, as improbable as it may seem, Jesus quite likely was Irish. After all, he thought his mother was a virgin. How obvious, and yet it took an extraordinary scholar to think of it. I am glad to introduce her, Professor Rachel Fulton Brown.
rather more of you here tonight than I expected. Did Jack Lewis invite you all? He would do that. He's always inviting people I don't know, like that Charles Williams fellow. Okay. So I have something to read to you that I've been niggling with. It's a little closer to allegory than history than I prefer, and I'm still not quite sure about some of the names. Does everyone have a drink? You may need it. Of the trees of light and knowledge and their fruits. It is told among the wise that the war between the powers began before the curriculum was full-shaped and anything yet grew or walked upon the quads. And for long, the Dark Lord controlled the reading lists. Then came Soul Tax, the strong, thundering wonderfully with his voice, and the Dark Lord fled before his wrath and his laughter, and there was peace for a long age. In that time, the Lords of the Core brought order to the lectures and the labs and the discussions, and the Queen of the Sciences planted at long last the seeds she had long devised. And at her prayer, her spouse, the Master of Crafts, wrought two mighty lamps for the lighting of Middle Quad. And the Lady of the Star filled them, and the Ruler of the Arts hallowed them, and the Lords of the Core set them upon high pillars, one near to the north, and it was named Rainstone. And the other in the south, and it was named Rainbard. And the light of the lamps flowed out over the quad so that all was lit, as it were, in a changeless day. Lit. Oh. The seeds that the queen had sown began swiftly to sprout and to burgeon, and there arose grasses and trees in the quads, and silvery beasts came to dwell among them and eat of their fruits. But while the Lords of the Core watched the growth and unfolding of the things they had devised and begun, the Dark Lord looked down upon them, and the beauty of the quad in its spring filled him more with hate. Then Soul Tax slept, being weary and content, and the Dark Lord came to the Middle Quad far in the north, and the Lords of the Core were not aware of him. Now the Dark Lord began the delving and building of a vast fortress deep under the quad, where the beams of the lamps were cold and dim. That stronghold was called, you don't know. No, that's silly. Too close to allegory? Yutumno? Stagfeld. No, that was in the west. And nothing would grow thereby. The lectures became choked with errors and ideologies. The labs grew dark and perilous, and the discussions became the breeding place of posturing and lies. Then the Lords of the Core knew indeed that the Dark Lord was at work again, and they sought for his hiding place. But the Dark Lord, trusting in the strength of you don't know, and the might of his post-axiomatic neo-narrative dematerialism, came forth suddenly to war and struck the first blow ere the Lords of the Core were prepared. And he assailed the lights of Rainstone and Rainbard and cast down their pillars and broke their lamps. In the overthrow of the mighty pillars, learning was disrupted and the disciplines arose in tumult. And when the lamps were spilled, destroying flame was poured out over the quad. I know I have light somewhere. String? In my pocket. Thus ended the spring of the quad. The dwelling of the Lords of the Core on the lake was utterly destroyed, and they had no abiding place in the quad. Therefore, they departed from Middle Quad and went to the land of the Blessed, the westernmost of all lands upon the borders of Academia. And since the Dark Lord was returned to Middle Quad and they could not yet overcome him, the Lords of the Core fortified their disciplines. And on the shores of the sea, they raised the mountains of the mind. And there, the Ruler of the Arts set his personal chair. In that guarded land, the Lords of the Core gathered great stores of tradition and all the fairest teachings that were saved from the Dark Lord's deconstructionism. And many others yet fairer they made anew, and they are not faded nor withered. Neither was there any stain upon the lessons in that land. For the very texts and experiments were hallowed, and great treasures were hidden there inside boxes without hinges, key, or lid. Okay, there's got to be a light in here. An egg? In that blessed land, there was a glassy mound. Grassy, and the queen of the sciences hallowed it, and she sat there long upon the glassy dome, egg, and sang a song of power in which was set all her thought of things that can be known about the earth. And as the lords of the core watched, out of the mound there came forth two slender shoots, and silence was over all the reading rooms in that hour. Nor was there any sound save the chanting of the queen. Under her song, the saplings grew and became fair and tall and came to flower, and thus there awoke in the world the two trees of the blessed land. The one had branches of silver, from which grew leaves of dark green, 8 branches in all, bearing shimmering fruits heavy with oil. The other had 6 branches of gold, 3 growing out of one side, and 3 out of the other side. Flowers swung upon her branches in 7 clusters of yellow flame, bearing fruits like almonds. You all look puzzled. It's all in Exodus. Does anyone teach you anything here? And from the blossom of that tree, there came forth warmth and a great light. Hanukkah, the one was called, and menorah, and kanukalomp, and many other names. But Ner Elohim, the other was, Oluxnos Toseu, and Lucerna Dei, light of God, and many names in song beside. There's got to be light. Hanukkah was the elder of the trees and came first to full stature and to bloom. And that first hour in which he shone the white glimmer of a silver dawn, the lords of the core named the matriculation hour and counted from it the ages of their reign in the land of the blessed. His light waxed for 8 hours of each day, growing more brilliant as each branch burst into flame. Ner Elohim was the younger tree and shone with the yellow blaze of a golden afternoon, and her 6 branches heavy with the fruits of wisdom and understanding, counsel and might, knowledge and the fear of the curve. The light that was spilled from the trees endured long ere it was taken up into the publications or sank down into the alumni events. And the lady of the star hoarded it in great vats like shining lakes that were all to all the lands as wells of learning and light. Thus began the days of the bliss of the blessed land, and thus also began the academic year. In that hour, the children of the quad awoke by the starlit mirror of Mishigama. And while they dwelt yet silent by the lake, their eyes beheld first of all things the 6 pointed stars of heaven, which the lady set as a seal upon the sky to protect and shield them. Therefore, they have ever loved the starlight and have revered the lady of the star, and they stay long awake to behold the beauty of the stars that she made. And on a time it chanced that Harper, the hunter, rode eastward in his hunting. And it seemed to him that in the quiet of the land under the stars, he heard afar off many voices singing as if in prayer. And looking on the children of the quad, he was filled with wonder. So I haven't quite finished this part yet. But in brief, what happens is Harper goes back to the lords of the core and tells them about the children. And the lords of the core want to bring the children to the blessed land. Some of the children come to the land and are awed by the glory and nobility. of the lords. And they counsel their people to heed the summons and remove into the west. But others refuse, preferring to wander in the starlight rather than to come to the light of the trees. Still others are ensnared by the Dark Lord and are corrupted and enslaved by him in mockery of the children. The lords of the core go to battle against the Dark Lord, and the shape of the whole curriculum is changed. So now the children of the quad are living in the light of the tree. Light, Light, light. A potato? In that time were made those things that afterwards were most renowned of all the works of the children. For Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, the son of Caleb, the son of Hezron, the son of Perez, the son of Judah, the son of Israel, being come to his full might, was filled with the spirit of the Maker, with wisdom and understanding and knowledge in all manner of work, to devise whatever may be made of root, an egg, of fruit and seed. Then he began a long and secret labor, and he summoned all his lore and his power and his subtle skill, and at the end of all he made the Lot Katoshin. As two great cakes they were in form, the one like unto a great circle, the other like a circle folded in upon itself, like unto a pouch or a pocket. But not until the end, when the term passes and the holiday falls, shall it be known of what substance they were made. Like the gold of Ophir it appeared, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, beautiful as a queen dressed in gold-woven robes as she comes into the presence of the king to beg for his favor on her people. Wait, that's a different story. Or maybe it's part of this one. What should her name be? Esther. Myrtle? Gladriel. No, wait, wrong language. Mary. No, that would be too obvious. Yet that gold was to the Lot Katoshin, but as is the body to the children of the quad, the house of its inner fire that is within it, and yet in all parts of it, and is its life. And the inner fire of the Lot Katoshin, Bezalel made of the blended sweetness and light of Hanukkah and Ner Elohim, which lives in them yet. Therefore, even in the darkness of the deepest cupboard, the Lot Katoshin of their own radiance shone like the star of the lady. And yet, as they were indeed living things, they rejoiced in light and received it and gave it back in tastes more delicious than before. All who dwelt in the blessed land were filled with hunger and delight at the works of Bezalel. And the lady hallowed the Lot Katoshin so that thereafter no hands unclean nor anything of evil will might touch them, but it was scorched and withered. And the registrar foretold that the fates of the quad, of the arts and the sciences, lay locked within them. The appetite of Bezalel was fast bound to these things that he himself had made, and all who ate of them were filled with their sweetness and light, and knowledge grew, and life was enriched. Okay, I see some of you are getting hungry. I have more about how the Dark Lord killed the trees and stole the Lot Katoshin with the help of Goliath, the giant spider, and how Bezalel swore a terrible oath, vowing to pursue with vengeance and hatred any power or creature that should keep the Lot Katoshin from his possession. The tale is fair, but long and sad, as are all the tales of Middle Quad. But told in full, still it may lift up your hearts, nor has it yet come to an end. Indeed, we are in the same tale still, for the Lot Katoshin were not all eaten by the Dark Lord and his spider or her children, but their light shines even now when we find ourselves in darkness and hungry for a tasty morsel of taters or cakes. There, now why can't I find a light? Wait, what's in my pocket? What should I do with it? Whoa. And if I may speak as myself, Professor Fulton Brown, you do realize that the elves are the children of the quad, and therefore the Jews are the people of the Blessed Land. Thank you.
Well, we are nearing the end. Let me assure you that we will be back next year, although I remain a little unclear as to just who sponsors us. Whoever they are, they have my thanks. As these installments in the great debate continue, now for well over half a century, I'm often asked why the question never seems to be settled. I can answer that perhaps best by reminding you of something that happened recently in the eastern United States. At a conservative synagogue in New Jersey, I think it was Bayonne, but I'm not sure of that. I am sure of the rest of the story. At that synagogue, a serious argument developed in the ritual committee. The argument was so intractable that it was brought to the board of directors and then to the entire congregation. This was the matter of contention. When the Shema is recited, should the congregation stand or remain seated? The side in favor of standing insisted that since the Shema is the most important declaration, everyone should stand in honor of its importance. The side in favor of sitting insisted that because it pervades all of Judaism's concerns, those reciting should remain seated, indicating the ubiquitous presence of the Shema. The congregants could not settle the argument, and both sides became ever more insistent and boisterous until they reached a point at which they knew the synagogue would break apart unless an agreement could be reached. They could agree on only one thing. If they could discover what had been the tradition when the synagogue was founded, they would agree to continue that tradition. Only one person survived from the synagogue's earliest days, a Jacob Bernstein, now living in an assisted living retirement home. And so a delegation of members of the sitting party, the standing party, went to consult him. A nurse at the home told them that Mr. Bernstein, now very old, was not always awake and lucid, but they insisted on waiting, and after some time, the nurse told them he was awake and attentive. They immediately went to his room, told him of their problem and the need to know what had been the synagogue's earliest practice, the tradition. Before he could answer, Mr. Bernstein fell asleep. And when he awoke, one of the congregation said, "Mr. Bernstein, you must tell us the tradition. Otherwise, we will go on fighting." It was standing for the Shema, wasn't it? "No," Bernstein said, "that was not the tradition." "Right," said the other fellow. "The tradition was sitting, wasn't it?" "No," Bernstein said, "that was not the tradition." "Mr. Bernstein," said one of the fellows, "this makes no sense. You must tell us what the tradition was. Otherwise, we will just go on fighting." "That was the tradition," Bernstein replied. Fighting was the tradition. Of course, this debate is never settled. What an idea. Next year, we will be back debating, fighting. Oh, I'd say I'm not sure how it will be sponsored. For now, please hustle over to Hutch to sample genuine latkes and hamantaschen and to vote for your favorite, although no one really cares who wins the election. And finally, as some of our Gentile friends try to put the Christ back in Christmas, let us put the back in Hanukkah. And now, thank you very much for coming. Thank you again for remaining seated while the distinguished panel exits.